Climate change will not be easy to reverse. 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere has often been cited as a number we could live with, but we're consistently over 400 now. And that's just about changing emissions in numbers. Our guest this hour talks a lot about changing human behavior and thinking. Bob Doppelt joined us a few years ago to talk about his concept of taking society from me to we, and he's stayed busy since. Bob is the executive director at the Resource Innovation Group, otherwise abbreviated as TRIG, and an adjunct instructor in the Department of Planning, Public Policy, and Management at the University of Oregon. He's written a new book called Informational Transformational Resilience, How Building Human Resilience to Climate Disruption Can Safeguard Society and Increase Well-Being. He'll be speaking tonight at 6 at the Medford Library at the monthly meeting of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Bob Doppelt, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you very much.
So your work goes back a couple of years. The Me to We stuff is where we got in with you about 4 years ago now. And so you've basically continued in that vein where you're talking about we really have to talk about changing ourselves before we talk about changing environment or the world around us.
Yeah, that's right. Part of it is how the environment is changing us. We are...
Hang on a second. We have a microphone issue here. I may have to switch. Can you just move over to the other microphone and we'll see if we can figure out what's going on? My apologies. We should probably do our mic checks before we get in the morning, before we get started. Let's see. That one works. Yeah, okay.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Yeah, I was saying that... In addition to teaching and writing, mostly what I do is I'm a practitioner. My organization has worked all across the U.S. and even some in Europe on climate change and sustainability issues. So what we're really looking at is how the climate is actually changing or affecting people as well as how people affect the climate. And what we're finding is a pretty significant impact on the way people think and act because of climate change. And that's what the new book's about and how we, and the focus is to how do we get out front of the negative aspects of those impacts.
So they think and act differently because of climate change or because of the way the climate feels on a particular day? In other words, is it just, you know, it's hot and stinky, I don't feel nice, that kind of thing? Or is it a little more of a psychic thing?
Well, all of us, trauma and what we call toxic stress is epidemic today in our society. And by toxic, we mean persistent and overwhelming stress. There's ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. Almost 50% of the children in the United States experience one or more adverse childhood experiences. There's family trauma. There's job difficulties. There's all sorts of rampant violence, as we've just experienced again. And all of those are really affecting us. And now to those traumas and stresses, we need to add climate change. There are the direct impacts, the physical impacts of big storms that we see, as well as the indirect toxic stresses of heat waves, droughts, rising diseases like Zika virus, etc. All of those create a fear-based response in humans. Climate change is aggravating many of the traumas and stresses we already experience and adding its own new ones. And that fear-based response is really shaping the way people are thinking and behaving and the way we're responding to a lot of things.
Is there then also a psychic factor in there? I mean, even if you're not being currently affected by anything involving climate or weather, is this sort of like, I'm going to guess our generation here, and we're worried about nuclear war, worried about what's coming from the climate, does it affect young people the same sort of way?
Absolutely. It affects everyone that way. You could call it vicarious trauma, where you're actually either seeing it directly, know somebody that's affected, or just observing that that's happening. You're experiencing, many people are experiencing that vicarious trauma. It's leading to trauma responses themselves in individuals. It's more anxiety, more depression. PTSD, if you're right in the middle of it and actually being experienced at it. Or if you're not, the vicarious trauma can also include helplessness, a sense of hopelessness, and we see that often. My organization runs workshops all over the country for many people who feel the situation is helpless and they're depressed about it and they don't know what to do. And so that's what my work and the book is about, and also our organization focuses on, is how to help people find hope and become engaged in these kinds of activities to really get out front of them.
Okay, as long as you're talking about your organization, let's get a slightly broader brush on that. And and get some idea of what the Resource Innovation Group is about.
Well, we are a nonprofit. We're affiliated with Willamette University, the Sustainability Institute at Willamette University. We have worked all over the country. We were one of the first, actually, engaged in what we call climate adaptation, or what's called climate adaptation. My staff went down to Southeast Florida and organized the Southeast Florida Climate Resiliency Compact. We actually, when Ted Kulongowski was governor here, we helped develop the framework for the state of Oregon's adaptation plan. We even, our staff even developed the what's called the American Society for Adaptation Professionals, the first group of people trying to professionalize the field. And so we've worked in all that way. We also do a lot of mitigation, that is reducing emissions work. But it's through all of that work that I realized we were missing probably the most important factor in dealing with climate change, which was the human reaction, the human focus. Most climate programs, I would say all climate programs, focus on external physical things, greenhouse gas emissions, energy efficiency, et cetera, or hardening physical infrastructure or helping natural resources adapt to warming temperatures, all of which is important. But what about the people?
Seems like a rather big area to leave out.
It was a shocker to me. I'm actually trained as a counseling psychologist in part, and as well as in environmental science. And yet my organization, just like all the rest, we were all focused on those external physical issues. Until it just became clear to me, it's like we have missed the big issue. And you saw it just in slight pieces of it after Superstorm Sandy that hit northeast the northeast of the U.S., where mental health problems went up, crime and violence went up. We've seen it around the country as that and around the world, especially as those impacts continue.
Bob Doppelt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He talks about building in some resiliency, both to people and planet. His new book is called Transformational Resilience, How Building Human Resilience to Climate Disruption Can Safeguard Society and Increase Well-Being. He'll be in Medford tonight addressing the monthly meeting of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN. That'll be at 6 o'clock at the Medford Library. You can join our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back in a minute 30 with Bob Doppelt and your phone calls and emails. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Bob Doppelt from the Resource Innovation Group. He also teaches at the University of Oregon. He is also a counseling psychologist. He's got lots of talents, but he's spending a lot of time thinking and talking about climate change and how we get society ready for climate change and how we get society ready to deal with climate change and to be aware of the kinds of things we'll be thinking and feeling as time goes on. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned in the introductory segment, Bob, about 50% of us have had adverse childhood experiences. Are we up-defining trauma? Are we just including a lot of things that we probably didn't used to include? I mean, 50% seems like a high number.
Yeah, that is actually comes out of research by Kaiser Permanente that started in California. It's now gone around the country. The Oregon Health Authority did it for Oregon. Each state is a little different, 47%, 51%. What it means is children experience physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, neglect. They live with a parent who's an alcoholic or a drug addict or is incarcerated. And so those experiences they find in children both depress their ability for brain development and for learning, because all of their energy is put into protecting themselves from that. And as adults, what we find, children with ACEs have much higher physical health problems and mental health problems. And that's just where we're starting from. So that we have 50% of our population that is roughly that have experienced one or more ACEs. And then we have these other traumas, and now we're adding climate change to that.
ACEs being adverse childhood experiences?
Yes, excuse me.
So 50%, though, I mean, has the number climbed over time? I mean, does Kaiser Permanente have a baseline from years ago that shows a lower percentage of society?
I don't know if they've done that kind of research. I think this research started about 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, and they continue to find it. It's actually gone global now. I've looked at research that found that pretty much same pattern in industrial nations. And it has to do with a lot of the ways we think and treat people. But it does suggest that trauma is prevalent in our society and that a lot of people are in a self-protective, defensive mode because of that, right from the get-go. And that makes it hard to get out front and start thinking long-term about dealing with these issues like climate change. It puts us in a survival mode that is very hard to overcome.
So to go back to your earlier work, this is really focusing on the me and incapable, up to a point anyway, of focusing on the we.
That's exactly right. What's interesting is that, you know, our society has this dominant mantra or dominant belief of what I call extreme individualism, that somehow we survive on our own, we make it on our own, et cetera. Well, that's not true at all. The fact is we're born from some other people, right? We breathe the air, which is dependent on the Earth's climate system. That's the only way we even exist. And everything about our lives is really connected with everything else. So that myth but that myth leads people to believe that they can take care of themselves. And it also leads to a lot of other issues that creates more trauma for people in their lives. And what we need to do now is build human resilience, as we call it, which is personal resilience, help people learn how to deal with, cope with the traumas and stresses they're dealing with now and the ones that are coming from climate change, as well as what we call psychosocial resilience. That is group resilience, resilience in communities and in organizations. In fact, what I'll be talking about tonight and what my organization is focused on is trying to get organizations around the U.S., whole communities around the U.S. to become trauma-informed, resilience-enhancing organizations. Many organizations and many communities actually simply reinforce trauma in people. And as climate change plays out, this is not a good thing. We really need to help people learn how to cope effectively with adversity and use adversity as a catalyst to learn and grow and thrive.
Bob Dopbelt of Eugene is our guest on The Exchange. His latest book is called Transformational Resilience. Let's talk about a trauma-informed approach. So this is basically acknowledging the 50% plus people who have adverse childhood experiences?
That's one form of it. In fact, the state of Oregon just passed a new law that Governor Brown signed about a month ago, 2 months ago now, to insert trauma-informed care into the school districts. But trauma-informed care has been growing in the social service field for many, many years. What I'm suggesting and what my organization is suggesting is that we expand that well beyond just social services to every organization, private, nonprofit, public, and every community. And what this means is, first of all, teaching people how the human brain and body responds to trauma and toxic stress, which is that our bodies actually release neurochemicals. Our brains release neurochemicals into our body to put us in a position to defend ourselves by fighting back or fleeing.
Cortisol.
Cortisol being one.
The stress hormone.
Yeah. And those overwhelming chemicals really change the way we think and act. So that's becoming trauma-informed, helping people understand what's going on within them or the people they're dealing with, and then learning skills to calm the nervous system when we're traumatized, and then increase their well-being. We call them presencing skills, to become more present, to calm your nervous system, and purposing skills, to find meaning, direction, and hope even when adversity continues on, rather than harming ourselves or harming other people, which is the natural response, that fear-based response to trauma and stress. And that's what we're seeing playing out around the world and certainly in the U.S. regarding the impacts of climate change.
So to become, and I'm looking at your Register Guard column from the 26th of May, Oregon should be first trauma-informed state. How does that get enacted on a day-to-day basis? I mean, does every person you come in contact with from any agency in the state of Oregon then work on the assumption that any client approaching them has some kind of trauma that needs to be addressed?
That would be one part of it. I think that's important. That to assume that even if someone, even if you're not treating somebody for trauma, or even if you're not thinking about that, they are responding in certain ways to adversities in their life. So the first question we all want to ask now, it's not just social service or educational agencies, is what happened to this person or to this group, not what's wrong with this person or group. So we put that into a different context and we begin to think about what they might be experiencing, and therefore that might help explain some of their behaviors and some of their thinking and might give us a different way to respond. But the next step is to make sure that whatever we do to respond when you're dealing with people is not to re-traumatize them through the way we interact with them and help them.
This sounds like a tricky space to find, though, for a couple of reasons. Number one, you're going to approach some people and you're going to wonder, okay, what happened to this person? And if you ever couch the question that way to that person, you're likely to get nothing, shut up. Or the opposite end of the spectrum, which could be constantly probing for things that happen to people that just raises stuff up again.
Yeah.
How do you find that middle ground?
I'm not suggesting either of those, actually. Okay. I'm just suggesting that we come in with the attitude that it might not be that something's wrong with them. They're morally bad. They're psychologically bad, et cetera. It's just that they've experienced something that might be creating the kind of behaviors you see. And just to be aware of that and try to respond in a different way without re-traumatizing them. So much of what we do, even in the schools, it's a good example, more discipline for kids that are acting out, rather than understanding what they might be reacting to without even asking them specifically. We're not talking about people becoming therapists. We're just having a different attitude. And that's just part of it, though. It's really the focus is to become aware that when humans are under experiencing trauma and toxic stress, they have a fear-based response, and then to build skills and implement tools and policies in our communities and organizations to help people build resilience for those traumas and stresses.
So the leading action of any person who works for any government agency then, or any public agency, is going to be to just to have softer hands, I guess, in a sense, to deal with people more nicely. Does this, and I don't mean to make a joke out of this, but I mean, does this include the DMV?
Yeah, I don't know about the DMV, but it's actually, again, well beyond government. This has to do with every private. In fact, much of the stress people are experiencing have to do with where they work, mm-hmm. their private work environment, where there's more pressure to do more and more with less and less because of the competitive pressures in the marketplace. How do you build resilience instead, rather than further traumatizing people if you're running a private organization? Your organization is going to be more productive as a consequence. It's going to cut costs because high turnover results when people are stressed and traumatized. There's all sorts of benefits, and a number of large corporations are actually taking that approach. So it's not about nicer gloves. Actually, it doesn't dismiss bad activities or bad behavior. It doesn't ignore that, but it does give you a different way to think about what's going on.
All right. So if you are a person who runs a private organization and you have workers for you and they're feeling stressed out, but your answer is going to be something along the lines of, well, I can't afford to work them any less hard. I can't afford to hire more people. I can't give them more days off because it just costs us money, you know, and the whole organization could fail and put them out of work. I mean, so how do you get around those often initial obstacles?
So the first step is, again, to teach some basic, simple skills. That's what my organization does. That's what the book is about. But that's really what resilience is about. It's not just a general concept. So there are simple skills people can learn in very short order. First of all, remember, when we're traumatized, when we're heavily stressed, our body is releasing these neurochemicals chemicals that's putting our nervous system, it's activating the sympathetic nervous system, which is one part of our nervous system. We want to activate the parasympathetic nervous system and calm the sympathetic. So one simple skill, you ask people to pay attention to the physical sensations in their body and find sensations that are pleasant and neutral versus unpleasant. We call that tracking. There's a whole wide variety of skills. We teach them to private organizations and others, and we find that people start using them in the middle of a meeting. They're doing that, and they calm their nervous system, and they're not just sitting there trying to protect themselves from what's going on. There's a number of other skills, too, we can dive into, but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about real-world activities, skills, tools that help people calm their nervous system and then find meaning and direction and hope in the middle of adversity rather than just reacting by trying to put these problems out of their mind as quick as they can or run from them, deny them, et cetera, which is what we're seeing on climate change.
Bob Doppelt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the executive director of the Resource Innovation Group attached to Willamette University. He's also an adjunct instructor in the Department of Planning, Public Policy, and Management at the University of Oregon. He is trained as a counseling psychologist. He's an author many times over. His latest book is called Transformational Resilience. And we're talking about a good deal of this in regards to climate change because he'll be speaking at Southern Oregon Climate Action Now's monthly meeting tonight at 6 at the Medford Library. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here is John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Doppelt.
Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Bob. It's a fantastic show. It's something that troubles me and I think about a fair amount. And what I wanted to kind of throw up here is, you know, when Katrina happened, it just seemed like the federal government just sat there and looked at these people. It really, really deeply bothered me and hurt me. And now I wanted to make sure that Bob's aware of this. I'm quite sure he is. But, you know, if there is an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, or a serious solar flare that created the Carrington effect back in the 1860s that melted all the telegraph wires. Our transformers and all of our computerized electrical system, you know, that feeds our nation, is going to basically be mangled if not completely shut down. And we're talking 3 days, and this country is in the dumpster. I'd like to see what Bob has to say about that.
All right. So how do we build in the resilience that can overcome a major disaster like that? For that matter, we can throw in the possibility of the Cascadia earthquake that is more of a when than an if in the eyes of geologists in Western Oregon. I mean, can you build in enough resilience to make for a quick comeback from events like those?
Well, first of all, there is a tremendous number of traumas that exist already or potential traumas that are out there. And when you build human resilience or personal and psychosocial resilience, you are building skills that people can use for all of those. But I think one of the issues that I heard raised was, what do we mean by resilience? Is it just bouncing back to where we are? We don't define it that way. I think that's a baseline. That's the minimum we want to do. Is to get back to where we were. But when you think about 50% of the children in the U.S. experience ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and all the people experiencing violence and crime, we don't want people just to bounce back to that. We want to increase well-being. And it turns out that when people learn these kind of simple resilience skills that we talk about in our book and workshops, they actually end up increasing their well-being. It's a whole field of psychology called post-traumatic growth, where people actually use adversity to learn and grow and increase their well-being. That doesn't mean they want or wanted that adversity to happen or that they ever forget it. In fact, it's always there in the background, but they use it as a way to learn and grow. That's what we need to do to prepare everyone with that, to help with all of these kinds of potential and real threats as time goes on.
The reference was to the Carrington event in September of 1859, where there was a major solar storm that actually did blow out telegraph lines in parts of the country. It was a really interesting sort of thing, which I want to read more about and understand a little better. Let's go to Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Doppelt.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Jeffrey, for having this program. This may be one of the most important ones of the year, I think. And, Bob, thank you for I'm going to try to make your talk this evening, and if I do get there, will you have books for sale?
Yes, I have a few.
Awesome. Okay. Well, you're hitting all the right buttons for me. The thing about ACEs, and you mentioned a little while ago that humans often feel the need to protect themselves when they're feeling under stress, like in a meeting or whatever. I'd like to point out that it's often totally unconscious. And Jeffrey, a year or so ago, you had the author of a book called Don't Even Think About It.
Oh, yeah.
That you interviewed. And what my perception is that when people are faced with something that triggers an unconscious fear, like the fear of environmental degradation and destruction and everything, they just shut down. It's the bottom line of the human nervous system to try to feel safe in an unsafe situation. And when that gets engaged, you lose a whole lot of your cognitive capacity for actually exploring it. So I'm really welcoming this book, and I'm going to try to get in touch with you and see what it can do to promote that in this area here.
All right. Thanks for that, Sandy. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you made a very good point, Sandy. Thank you. What's happening in our brain, the lower part of our brain, the humans have what we call the amygdala, which you could call the fear and alarm center of the brain. It's always looking around, unconsciously looking around for a threat that you might experience.
Is this the so-called reptile brain?
Yeah, basically. We call it the fear and alarm brain. And it evolved over thousands of years. In, 10,000, 20,000 years ago, we were mostly looking for predators, and there was a whole lot of them then, many more than now, because they're extinct. But when it does that, it immediately releases those neurochemicals I talked about into the brain. So it's a very natural response. In fact, it's a good thing we have that. That's how humans have been able to evolve and become the most dominant species on the planet. But we also have something in the upper part of our brain that most other mammals don't have. We share the fear and alarm center with most others. We have the prefrontal cortex. That's where you build resilience.
That's where you can think about the threats and you can determine whether or not they're as real as they appear to your, I keep wanting to call it the reptile brain.
No, that's fine. And that's exactly right.
Bob Doppelt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll get back to climate change because he'll be talking about that very thing in Medford in the context of transformational resilience tonight at 6 at the Medford Library. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back with Bob Doppelt and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange. It's our final segment today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Bob Doppelt of Eugene. He is the executive director of the Resource Innovation Group. He teaches courses at the University of Oregon and at Willamette University. He's a counseling psychologist. He's an author several times over. We talked to him 4 years ago about his book, Then, From Me to We. He's taken the concept further with something called Transformational Resilience. That's the title of his new book, subtitled How Building Human Resilience to Climate Disruption Can Safeguard Society and Increase Well-Being. Bob will be speaking tonight at the monthly meeting of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. That'll be at 6 o'clock at the Medford Library. And you can join our discussion now on the Jefferson Exchange about resilience, about climate change, about how we handle just about anything in the world around us as a society as well as individuals. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. The idea of a trauma-informed society or the trauma-informed culture gets, again, to an interesting place where we're making the assumption then that we're making the assumption that half the people around us have been through something adverse at some point in their lives.
Yeah, actually way more than half. Mm-hmm. The half have experienced adverse childhood experiences, but when you add either directly being involved with or witnessing the shootings that are going on, other forms of violence, family abuse, spousal abuse, on and on and on, we see that many, many people in our society are already traumatized or severely stressed. And actually, so one of the things we did is we organized something called the International Transformational Resilience Coalition, ITRC. We have over 200 mental health, resilience building, trauma treatment specialists, mostly from the U.S., but also from Europe and Asia. And we're promoting a global movement to build human or psychosocial and personal resilience. So we're proposing that the U.S. and every state in the U.S. and every city Ashland, Medford, Eugene, every coastal city, should become a trauma-informed, resilience-enhancing community. Teach the psychobiology of trauma and stress to everyone, not just adults and not just children, but adults also in the private sector, public sector, nonprofit sector. Teach what happens when we're traumatized to our brains and body, and then teach skills to help people deal with that, cope with those adversities in ways that actually help them increase their well-being. This should become a major movement. It will help us deal with climate change and with a whole lot more.
There again, there's some resistance to overcome. And pardon me if I keep harping on this, but I mean, there are a fair number of people I would think who don't want to be thinking of themselves as being defined by trauma that happened to them, even or as children or as at any other point in life.
I think that's right. Well, first of all, there is a stigma to mental health problems, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about increasing your personal, your organizational, your community resilience, which is very different. In fact, it sort of gets to the heart of the climate change movement. In climate change, climate adaptation is thought of as sort of identifying, fixing vulnerabilities. Building resilience is completely different. It's focusing on identifying and building on strengths. So it's trying to help people strengthen their capacity because humans are pretty resilient anyway, naturally. But it can be overwhelmed. So how do we increase those skills, those capacities in our communities, in our organizations, and in our personal lives?
So what are some of the first steps then that that people take here? I mean, when you're trying to build a trauma-informed, what does the R stand for? Resilient. There we go. We're resilient. My handwriting is so bad. Yeah.
Right.
So when you're trying to build a community that is trauma-informed and resilient, then what are some of the first steps you take to moving ahead from where we are to where we want to be?
Well, one of the very easy first steps is for the Rotary Club and the Chamber of Commerce and all sorts of organizations, certainly the school districts and others, to begin just holding little talks to help people understand what I call the psychobiology of trauma and stress. What happens in your brain and in your body that you can't control when you are facing trauma and stress, and talk about how those neurochemicals affect your body, what a fear-based response is, a flight or fight response, and also what a freeze response is also. And that's when those chemicals reactions get so overpowering that you actually can't even move. So just help people understand that and get that information out widely. And then the second, as you're doing that, help people learn simple skills that they can use to calm themselves when they're experiencing that, or how they can respond to somebody else that they see or experience that's having that kind of reaction without re-traumatizing them. Very simple steps, but it starts with, let's just get this information out there, begin a dialogue about it. It is out there. There's a program called Trauma Informed Oregon that's run out of Portland State University that runs it, but it's mostly focused on the social service sector. We need to expand that to everyone in the state.
All right, we got more phone calls for you. Let's go first to Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Doppelt.
Yes, I love the topic. When my mom was raising us, she pretty much gave us the message that we could handle what would happen to us rather than trying to protect us from getting hurt and having, you know, negative experiences. She just, you know, she had confidence that we could handle it, we could talk about it, we could, you know, work it through, and we could handle it and move on. And that was really helpful. And then also that if someone else was hurt, we would find a way to help them. And those were such good messages. And I worry sometimes now that some of the parenting focuses on protecting children from any negative experience.
Well, thank you for that, Cynthia. Yeah, I think those are good messages. Let me add, though, something else. That one of the key resilient skills that we know based on research and probably your experiences is actually your social support network. And so one of the skills we want to focus on, and what a trauma-informed community would focus on, is helping people clarify who their true allies are, who is their social support network, expand it if it's weak or if it's not very large, and strengthen that Because when we're traumatized and stressed, often the best thing we can do is reach out to our friend, go out to have lunch or go have coffee with Sally down the road, who you really can count on to give you honest feedback and support you, or get some practical assistance from Uncle Joe, whatever it might be. And often when we're traumatized, we forget to reach out. We forget to contact and be held and be nurtured by these people. Often it doesn't take long. Just a short contact just brings us back. It calms our nervous system. So it's not just doing it on your own. In fact, the social support networks are critical for especially long-term overwhelming trauma and stress.
How does an individual, though, expand the support network if the individual's already somewhat isolated? I mean, this is a country where people move away from their families to get jobs and end up in towns where they don't know people, or friends and family die, or any one of a number of things happen. But, I mean, from how long ago was the book Bowling Alone? It seems like it was around 1990 or so. But we do a lot of things by ourselves in this country and don't tend to reach out to networks easily, or at least within the last couple of decades.
No, that's exactly right. And that's why I focused on in a previous book on From Me to We. We have to move back to that sense of we. But there are certain things that your community or your neighborhood can do. Just get to know your neighbors well by holding block parties, for example. There's a number of communities around the world that are actually two or three times a year, they block off the streets and they ask everybody to come out and share food and talk, get to know each other. We do a little exercise called Circles of Support, where you actually have people identify who their true allies are, so to speak. And often people go, oh my gosh, I don't have any. And then, okay, what can you do? Can you join a couple of groups? Go to a couple of meetings, different organizations that you sort of like. Go on hikes with groups, et cetera. So take specific steps to start building your social support network. It's often a real eye-opener when people realize they don't have one.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the key points here is that in order to become a trauma-informed society, you really have to have a greater level of honesty than perhaps is present in society now. Being able to be honest about what has happened to you and being willing to listen to other people about the things they've been through.
Yeah, I think that's really a core element. We really have now evolved into us versus them thinking, and we only talk with and interact with people who think and act and share information that we already believe in, and that really makes it difficult to interact with others. But we know these are evidence-based skills that we're talking about, meaning we know these things work. We know these skills, these methods work, and I really encourage people around the state to begin to think about them.
What about, though, the issue where, I mean, we're, you and I come from a generation, I presume, pardon me if I'm lumping us too close in age here, but where we were told not to talk to strangers. So getting to know people in the first place can be a bit of a trick.
Well, again, I think there are very specific tools and methods that can be used to do that in a safe way. Create safe environments, even in your workplace, you know, when you're working with people, but certainly in avocational, recreational opportunities, in your churches or your faith organizations, there's ways to do that, especially if we focus on it. And even from the parks perspective and recreation perspective, begin to design our parks and our outdoor spaces to facilitate human interaction, not just play. But how do we facilitate human interaction? I just ran a long workshop for the state of Massachusetts on this, where the climate folks were trying to restore wetlands, but not thinking about how humans could interact there. So we really need to expand the way we're thinking about these issues, to think about how do we build social support networks, even in all the work we do.
Massachusetts case is interesting. So they were talking about how to restore nature, but not to include humans as part of it?
It's not that they were excluding it. They hadn't thought about it. They had just organized a new adaptation network of different organizations, include the Nature Conservancy and others, and thinking about how they can build human resilience, psychosocial and personal resilience, within the context of doing their external physical resilience hadn't been thought of. And so hopefully now, after this workshop, they're now thinking about it. Certainly the feedback afterwards was very good. And I think that's the same thing for Oregon. We have to do this cross-sectoral integrative work, just focusing on climate adaptation in the physical environment or climate mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and not incorporating humans and human responses and building resilient skills in those two elements is not really going to work. And I'll say one more thing very quickly. The mental health field also needs to expand. It only focuses now on treating people who have symptoms of trauma and stress. We're only halfway to the temperature increase we're going to see as climate change plays out, and maybe way less than halfway. And so we're never going to be able to treat all of the people that are impacted by the traumas and stresses of climate change afterwards. We've got to build preventative methods. We've got to begin to focus on preventative programs to build skills ahead of time to help people deal with these.
You know, I haven't heard the term in 45 years. It was from health class in seventh grade. But mental hygiene, do we not think in those terms, in terms of prevention with mental health? You just mentioned we don't think of, we think about treating things once they've gone wrong. But in mental health, do we not think in terms of preventive care?
Very little. That's not to say people aren't concerned about it, don't think about it, but there's no funding for it. There's no focus on it. It's really a reactive focus based on what's available in terms of the resources. We need to change that. And it's, again, not focused on treating mental illness only. We need to do that also, but on building resilience skills. So there's less mental illness at the other end.
Becca in Rural Lane County writes, it's hard to imagine lots of people outside of the psychological profession and community really doing this. Maybe a lot more women than men. Difficult, as you said, seeing many as defining themselves by damage from trauma. Maybe if a catastrophic event actually happens, this might come together. I'm in a rural community with a neighborhood group that would take care of each other, but probably in a more traditional way, such as sharing water, shooting anybody who threatened one of us, and we'll assume that sort of thing. So that's from Becca.
Rebecca, thank you for that. I think actually our experience over the last 3 or 4 years running this kind of work is that many, many people get engaged with it. They get excited about it, in fact. It's not just people in psychology. In fact, often people in psychology do just what I was talking about. They think only in terms of treating problems. I think many people are interested in what we find is many different kinds of people want to increase their resilience in many, many ways. So, and I think it's great that you're going to share water and food, et cetera. The question is, what happens over the long term? Not just the near term. What happens over the long term? How do you interact? How do you support each other, et cetera? That's really the key, because climate change is going to go on for 100 to 200 more years minimum.
So a lot of that is that gets to the adaptation, and there's also mitigation to be talked about here with climate change. And boy, in the 1 minute we have left, can you sum up that?
Well, in the climate field, mitigation means reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Again, it's mostly focused, it's almost exclusively focused on external physical things, energy efficiency, shifting away from fossil fuels to renewables, et cetera. But there's many ways to incorporate humans learning resilience skills, building their social support networks, et cetera, within that kind of work. But right now, it's almost non-existent. It's really done by the technical experts, the policy staff, the scientists, et cetera. And we really need to make it more integrative. There's lots of opportunity there. We simply have made our focus on climate change too narrow, and we need to expand in the climate field and in the mental health field.
Bob Dopbelt has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Transformational Resilience. He wrote From Me to We, and we joined him for that. He joined us for that 4 years ago. He'll be speaking tonight at 6 at the monthly meeting of SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. That's at 6 at the Medford Library. Bob Dopbelt, thanks for joining us again on the Exchange.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Good to have you.